Welcome to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich. This is a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Ohio leads the nation in the percentage of stroke cases, according to the CDC. A company is using new technology to boost stroke recovery, and it's opened its first clinic in New Albany. Joining us now is neuroscientist Omar Ahmed, CEO of NeuroAnimator. Welcome to All Sides, Omar.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. It's NeuroAnimation, just a slight correction.
NeuroAnimation. I'm sorry. I made it a singular. NeuroAnimation. Thank you. So let's get started with a simple explanation. Tell me what NeuroAnimation is. What are you doing there?
So NeuroAnimation is a type of therapy where we use technology to engage the brain and the body in kind of an unprecedented way. So it offers stroke sufferers and people with brain injury a sort of high dose, high intensity workout that stimulates the right part of the brain, which we believe sends blood to that region of the brain and then strengthens it. Often, you know, residual functionality after injury, so it comes back online to help them recover.
Now, are you using, what kind of technology is in this? Are you using virtual reality, augmented reality? The website made it kind of look like VR and gaming.
So we use both. So there's two real key components to it. One is you have to track a patient very, very meticulously. So you have to have data of their fingertips, their arm, their upper limb in real time. And then you take that information and you put it into our software and our experience, where we feed that into virtual animals. These animals move to your subtlest movements. They engage your brain in very enriched ways. And it's in that exploratory movement process that the therapy essentially takes form and works for the patient.
So when I watched the video on your website, I mean, the animals are swirling around you. There's a beautiful octopus, and you are encouraging patients. You want them to reach out and touch them. That's how they're getting their hand-eye coordination, right?
Yeah. So you want to enrich the environment, and you want to give the users or the patients a sense of physics, a sense of dynamics. So when you're blindly repeating movement tasks after brain injury, there's lots of evidence that that's actually not doing much for your recovery process. Mm-hmm. What we want to do is engage the brain, kind of in a maximal way where you're motor planning continuously, where you're doing things that you haven't done before. You're learning new motor tasks that you haven't done before. And that's really what the game enables you to do.
Is there a reason you picked animals? I mean, I guess you could have animated food or plants or something. Why animals?
Yeah. Well, there's two reasons. One, most people develop an empathetic connection with animals. They bond with them. It becomes a deep part of their therapeutic experience that they're working with this virtual creature to heal. And the second part is we want to give people dynamics that they're familiar with, but also unfamiliar with. Mm-hmm. So we watch dolphins, we see how they move. And the idea here is that how do you turn someone into a dolphin or an octopus or a sea lion or all these different creatures so they can explore the movements in those spaces?
And what clinical trials have you had? They're showing, what kind of results are they showing?
So we're showing incredible results with our clinical studies. The first clinical trial on NeuroAnimation therapy was a study called SMARTS2. And what it showed was twice the effectiveness over standard of care in the early period after stroke. Now that's really significant, right? If your movement, and it was determined on a test called the ARAT, which measures dexterity in the hand, your grip, your grasp, your pincer, and your upper arm movement. So these are movements which reflect the quality of movement after brain injury like stroke. So it was double the effectiveness. So if people on average get about 10 points on their ARAT from stroke onset to recovery, we were doing over 20, right? It was basically double the effectiveness. Now for a small subset of the population, that means returning to normal versus having an impairment for the rest of their life. So this is really, really significant. This was recently confirmed in a study in Ben Gurion University in Israel, where we also, again, it showed the twice the effectiveness with the measured ARAT score. And this shouldn't be, you know, this should be emphasized that stroke patients right now, it's almost tragic what they're given after injury in terms of the intensity, the dose, and the quality of the rehab for recovery. It's not enough. All the science, thousands of papers now show that it's not enough. Europe has taken steps to offer much higher doses and much more enriched types of therapies after stroke, but we don't do that here. After the stroke, after someone's small amount of rehab ends, there's really nothing they can do. So this is why it's very important to get that extra level of enrichment on top of their rehab, in addition to their rehab, to maximize their recovery potential.
I want to bring into the conversation Brad Martinkovich, Vice President of Commercial Development and Sales for NeuroAnimation, and he's based at the New Albany office. Now, Brad, Ohio and New Albany were picked for a specific reason. What was that?
Hi, Amy.
Hi.
We discovered, as you did, that Central Ohio in general has a abnormally high stroke population compared to the rest of the country. And New Albany, Ohio is becoming, and around New Albany is becoming a Midwest tech hub. Big tech is moving in this area, and we feel like New Albany was the perfect place to set up the most technologically advanced therapy on the planet. And I'm happy to do it right here in New Albany. It just fit everything we were looking for.
Do you know why Central Ohio has is at a higher risk for stroke?
Omar could probably speak on this a little bit better than I can.
So we it's most likely part of it is the obesity epidemic, which is, you know, concentrated in the Midwest. Also, you know, there's other factors that we just don't know. Some could be environmental, some could be you know, toxicity in the environment. We're not sure, but overall lifestyle factor is probably the largest factor that's contributing to the high stroke. It's also younger people in Ohio are getting more strokes, which is very abnormal.
Okay. So Brad, can you give us a sense of the facility, how it's laid out? When a patient comes in, what do they do?
Absolutely. So we are a concierge model. Meaning that every step here the patient takes is choreographed, if you will. So we greet them at the door. Our facility, it was a million-dollar build-out, and it's absolutely gorgeous. We have a beautiful waiting area with even high tech in that area with what we've done with projectors there. We bring them in. We have a beautiful conference room set up for them. And we also then have a pre-examination room where, if they need to get some light massage or stretching, we have that ability here. And then we have two 12 by 12 animation theaters where we can deploy the therapy and where most of the session takes place. And then we have about a 3,000 square foot. We call it a gym, but it's not really a gym. We're not a traditional therapy center. So it's a big open space where we then kind of match the, they call it consolidation work. So after the theater therapy, we kind of match what the customer is most interested in. So if it's painting, if it's music, if it's gardening, if it's golf, we have the ability to really tie into their wants, needs, and goals, and just deliver a very unique experience.
Now, either Brad or Omar, you can answer this. How are you getting? I know this is relatively new business, but how are you getting patients? Are there referrals from local doctors? How do people learn about this therapy?
So far we've had a pretty strong amount of interest directly from patients. So we've done a lot of education, you know, social media, informing people, educating people. There's a very robust demand for this type of work because a lot of patients understand that what, you know, what can I do more? I've been told I can't do anything. So it's sort of meeting that natural expectation with the word of mouth. We are, you know, hopeful to talk to the physicians. There's some amazing stroke physicians actually in the area who are interested in, you know, offering something else to their patients who can recover beyond standard care.
Now, this is a to go and get this therapy. This is private pay, right? So insurance companies are not footing the bill.
Correct.
Would that be a goal for you? Would you want to get insurance companies involved, or you think you'll stay a private pay
No,
model? Okay.
we want to stay private pay because it really puts the resources and technology and money directly into the patient care. We're trying to maximize the technology at all steps. Our goal is to create the highest outcomes, the highest recovery achievable. So, having that overhead just takes resources away from our technology and the patient. We want it to go directly to the patient care provided, and we find that that's the best model. I think over time, this will get to the expense level that we can, that most people will be able to afford it.
Yeah, what's the cost per session? Is there a standard fee?
We're still working out the economics of the model, but it's less than what you'd pay for a highly specialized neuro PT or OT, for example, that usually do cash pay work. So, it's the we're determining the kind of the packages. Brad can speak a little bit more to that.
Yeah, Brad, your office opened in early February. Can you talk about the first patients that have been there, and a little bit about the cost model.
Yep. So technically, I know the website said early February. We are just opening now. We're expecting our first patients next week. So it's really dependent on the patient and what they're looking for. So we spearheaded stroke. We have a 3-week stroke boot camp that's going to run generally about $200 an hour, maybe a little bit under. So you're looking at 5 days, 3 hours a day. For 3 weeks. So Monday through Friday, 3 hours per day, about an hour and a half of actual in theater work, two sessions, 45 minutes a piece is showing the best results. So, but the overall experience per day here is about 3 hours, 5 days a week, 3 weeks, and it'll run about $9,000. We also have a 12 week, so there's been studies and a lot of great results coming from a 12-week program for executive function and processing speed. So aging customers that are looking for those two things, that's a 12-week program, only 2 days a week, an hour per session. So 2 hours per week, 12 weeks, and that's going to run about to say about $5,000 for that 12-week program. And like Omar said, we're still working out the cost models and fine-tuning everything here. But we hope to offer other things, including executive function and processing work for children. Our theaters are absolutely perfect for that demographic. It's a very fun experience, and my daughter has been in the theater and absolutely fell in love with these creatures. And I think there's a lot of promise in that area as well.
Now, Omar, is this, I mean, we're talking specifically about stroke patients, and you did say that stroke patients can be a wide range of ages. It's not just elderly people having strokes. But are you seeing this being applicable to other types of brain injuries too?
100%. So the it's a very ubiquitous brain strengthening platform. The reason why it has a very generalized effect, we have some very exciting results that will be presented at an Alzheimer's conference in July. We have strong results in the healthy elderly. We have strong results across the spectrum, non-stroke injuries. So the question is why? Why is it ubiquitous? Why does it work? It all centers on blood flow to certain regions in the brain which contribute to neuronal growth. So we know that blood flow and new neurons and neuronal structures are symbiotically related. So the more you can put blood into a certain region, the more the neurons there are likely to strengthen and residual functioning can be strengthened there. So it's because of that effect and that mechanism we see, effects in multiple different categories of brain injury where cognition and movement or even cognition alone is, has some deficit.
Yeah, and I mean, I was drawn to this idea of what you were doing because whenever I read that stroke patients were seeing like double the results of traditional therapies and getting back function, I mean, that's just amazing. I had a family member who had a stroke, and just never was able to use their hand and arm in the same way again for years. So you're seeing positive results in that aspect, yes, where they're able to do get back to life as they knew it before the stroke.
Absolutely. And chronic, you know, patients who've suffered a stroke immediately, so we call those acute patients, they have a enormous potential to recover, even in some cases, back to normal. In the chronic population, there are meaningful gains that patients can make. I like to quote Steve Kramer, who's a stroke neurologist out of UCLA, who says it's time to end the nihilistic view that we can't make recovery gains for chronic stroke patients. It's absolutely true. It does require intensity, and it does require a connection between your movement and something that's cognitively stimulating and enriching. And these are, you know, this is where technology really opens the door for patients to recover in a way that they couldn't do before. You know, there, it's not easy to do these types of activities outside the context of this technology, right? People don't move in arbitrary ways during the day and have random balls in three-dimensional space that they're trying to work out or work out the dynamics for. So it's really that combination of the intense dose and the technology itself, which is going to change a lot of people's lives.
All right. I want to say thank you to neuroscientist Omar Ahmed, CEO of NeuroAnimation. Thank you so much for being here, Omar.
Thank you.
And also thank you to Brad Martinkovich, Vice President of Commercial Development and Sales for NeuroAnimation. Good luck with your official opening.
Thank you so much.
And coming up, we're going to talk about how to know if your boss is spying on you. That's when Tech Tuesday continues on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. A First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Elon Musk over the weekend delivered an ultimatum to federal workers: justify your work or resign. The action left those in and out of government wondering if their jobs are safe. How far might your boss go to justify productivity and monitor your work? Haley Sokoyama is an associate director of legislative activism with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a digital rights group. Welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having me.
So you were quoted in a Washington Post story that inspired this segment. The title was, "Your employer might be spying on you. Here's how workers can check." So most of us assume that if we're using a company-owned device, an employer can see what we do. But is that true? Is there more to it than that?
Well, I think you're right that people assume, you know, if you're using a work a device that's owned by your employer, that certainly they have access to that device. Mm-hmm. But I think particularly what we saw in the pandemic, when we saw this kind of explosion of remote work, was that there was more sort of active monitoring or regular monitoring. And I think that can catch people off guard.
So the idea of the active monitoring, are you talking about just seeing if your mouse is moving, like keeping your computer awake, or are people actually monitoring what websites you're on or what you're actually physically doing on your computer?
Yeah, so that varies by sort of employer. Certainly, I'm not saying all employers are doing one thing or another, but there are definitely types of software out there that can do things like activity monitoring. So seeing what apps and websites you're using. They can take periodic screenshots of your device so that they can send that somewhere to let people know what your screen looked like at any time. And then, you know, as you say, sort of checking on your mouse or keylogging, right? Seeing what you're typing on your keyboard.
Okay. So how do you know if your employer is taking a screenshot of your screen or checking on what you're typing?
Yeah, I wish I had better news. So, I mean, sometimes if you look at that Washington Post article, there are certain ways that you could maybe guess at it, right? Mm-hmm. You could see if there are apps that are installed on your computer or your device that are, that are companies that make this sort of software. You can see what sort of access your employer has, like what level of access your employer might have to your device. But there are some types of software where, one of the features is that they can be made invisible. And so it can be a little difficult to determine. I would hope and I would encourage most employers who are thinking about this kind of software that to that they would disclose that information to their workers so that people are aware of what's happening. I think, I understand that employers often want to keep people accountable. I get that. But I think if you do this in secret, you run the big risk of rupturing trust between you and your employees.
Yeah, that was I wanted to know if you have you thought about the from the employer's perspective, what is the employer's goal in monitoring an employee device?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is, it is accountability, right? I mean, I think there is a constant drive in a lot of organizations for efficiency. I think they want to make sure that people are doing the job that they've hired them to do. And so one way that I could see, I don't personally agree with it, but one way that I could see employers trying to meet that goal is to just say, okay, well, we'll just keep an eye on everybody all the time, or more often, sort of, monitor people, but do random checks, right? So kind of drop in so that people don't know when they're going to have their work kind of looked at.
Yeah, I would think that even on a employer-owned device, everyone does a few personal things here and there. I mean, you check your personal email. Sometimes you have to, go on Amazon and quickly order something. It happens. It's a part of being a human, I would think. So is that some pushback you would hear from employees that tracking me all the time, I can't work for 8 hours straight nonstop?
Yeah, definitely. And you're totally right. Plus, there's a privacy component, right? I
Mm-hmm.
think a lot of times in those emergency situations when you have to do a little bit of, something personal on your computer, and you're like, okay, I'm going to take a 5-minute break and, schedule a medical appointment or do something with my kid's school. Like those are really, really sensitive pieces of information. You may not want your employer to know that. It's likely none of their business. And so sort of the fear that they might, that something might get disclosed that you don't want disclosed, even if it's not damaging to work, it might be embarrassing or it might just be something you want to keep quiet. So, yeah.
And it depends on how the work device is locked down. Like I work at Ohio State University. I can't download an application without IT approval, right? But some devices, you can download a personal app onto a work device. Can an employer collect information from that if you have a personal app on your work device?
That's a good question. I don't know that it would probably depend on the situation, to be honest. I think, if it is a case where they're monitoring things like screenshots or key logging, certainly they could see what you see when you're looking at your device. I don't know necessarily if they could pick up any additional information, but yeah, I'm not positive about that.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides, and we're talking about how your boss can use technology to spy on you with Haley Sokoyama, an Associate Director of Legislative Activism with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a digital rights group. So, since you work for a digital rights group and you're working in legislative activism, would this be something? Could there be a law to prevent employers from spying on people? Should there be a law? I'm not sure how to ask it.
There have been, I'll put it this way. There have been laws proposed. Certainly we've seen, there are different ways that different professions interact with this kind of technology. So, for example, warehouse workers have gotten quite a bit of attention. Folks who are working for retailers such as Amazon, where they were being monitored and, timed based on like how quickly they were doing tasks. And that, raised concerns about, their physical health, right? Like whether that those were violating health and safety standards. So we've seen some push in California and I believe Minnesota's to like disclose what those quotas are and saying like if you can't make a quota that would violate health and safety laws, for example. And now we're seeing a little bit more around electronic monitoring. A lot of it is, just sort of saying, if you're using this kind of technology, you have to disclose it to your workers. And I should be clear, a lot of businesses that use this do disclose it in, you know, employee handbooks, or unions have been very active in making sure that it's a, you know, an upfront thing when they're bargaining or in contracts, that they're aware, either made aware of electronic monitoring and given rights to know, like, how what information is being used to judge whether someone is good at their job or whether they might be dismissed. And also a right to appeal, right? Because sometimes that's the other issue, right? Software can monitor and can maybe take some data that they think paints a full picture of what's happening, but, you know, there are always mistakes that can be made. And so we are seeing kind of unions take the lead on negotiating that, and we're starting to see some of those proposals come into law.
Yeah, I can definitely see from a legislative standpoint the Amazon example you gave, because I read stories about an Amazon worker who, you know, supposedly spent 1 minute too long longer in the bathroom than was allotted in their package delivery day. And, you know, that's just sad.
Yeah, I think, you know, for a lot of people, they think, well, you know, if I have nothing to hide, I don't mind getting monitored. But in those kinds of situations, it can be very dehumanizing, right? To just think like, I think it makes people feel, and, you know, it kind of treats them as like just a cog in the machine that doesn't have feelings or can't have any variance in the mood of their day. You know, we all have good days and bad days, and some days we work harder than others. So that doesn't seem like something we should be punished for.
Now, you mentioned earlier there are names of these tracking softwares, and you could just go into the search bar on your work-owned device and type in the name of the app and see if it's on your computer or not, right? But are there a lot of them? Like, would it be hard to figure out like all the names?
It could be, and you know, and again, I think that is one method, but there are some that specifically say like, oh, we can hide from things like that.
So there are invisible apps too?
There are invisible apps.
Okay.
Yeah, but we have a couple listed on our website, and then there's an organization called Coworker that has just a great list of applications that folks may want to look at. And I think through their, what they call their little brother database, that can be a good guide too, to sort of, if you see something on your device and you're like, oh, that seems kind of like a strange name. You know, a lot of these have names like InterGuard or Staff Cop or Time Doc. So, you know, if you see something like that, that might be a good place to check.
What would your recommendation to be for a worker who thinks they're being tracked? How can they approach their boss in just in a spirit of transparency to say, hey, are you doing this? Is that something you'd recommend?
I mean, I would say that really depends a lot on your workplace. If you feel like, you know, I would hate for people to lose their jobs over asking something like this. But I think, you know, if there is a person that you trust on the management team, or you know, if there is a mechanism in your workplace to kind of raise concerns like this, I think if you see something, probably what I would do is, if I saw something on my computer, I would just say, hey, do you know what this is? You know, do kind of frame it as a transparency question. But I really encourage people to sort of know their own workplaces about whether that's a welcome conversation or not. And I would just encourage everybody to use, if possible, personal devices, or at least do stuff off work hours if you can. Obviously, I understand that's a very difficult thing to do, but just as a regular practice, kind of try and keep those personal work lives as separate as you can.
Now, I mentioned you're the Associate Director of Legislative Activism with a group called the Electronic Frontier Foundation. So I identify that as a digital rights group. Can you tell me about your mission, the Electronic Frontier Foundation?
Yeah, sure. So the Electronic Frontier Foundation, or EFF, which is much easier to say,
yes,
was founded in 1990, so quite early for a digital rights organization. And we advocate broadly for policies that improve privacy, that fight unwanted surveillance, that promote free expression, and that promote innovation.
Okay, so, you know, you're a digital rights group that seemed ahead of its time. If you started in 1990, I don't know how much internet was out there then. What are the prevailing things that you are working on now, besides, you know, helping people figure out if their boss is spying on them? What's your most biggest part of your activism right now?
Yeah, so we do a lot of privacy advocacy. Again, as I'm a legislative person, you know, I work a lot in thinking about bills and laws. Mm-hmm. Particularly, I manage our state level portfolio. So right now, a lot of bills are pouring in from across the country. So reading a lot of them, I think some trends that I'm seeing include a lot of AI legislation. So that also implicates workers, right? Just sort of thinking about, you know, how AI collects information, how it uses that information, and whether it's being used to circumvent, for example, discrimination laws, mm-hmm. right? Or in the workplace, in housing. So doing a lot of evaluation around that. And then also thinking a lot about privacy. You know, I think it's no surprise that a lot of states are moving in different directions with their policies right now. So we're seeing a lot of bills, for example, trying to make sure that data from one state doesn't cross over to another state. So lots of privacy and AI work.
Yeah, I was wondering if you mentioned it's kind of state by state. Are a lot of these privacy laws that are being proposed, is it a state by state thing versus a federal level?
Yeah, I think federal consumer privacy legislation is something that a lot of people would like to see, but. I started my career before I was at EFF. I was a reporter, and that in DC in 2010, and that was definitely the year we were going to get a data privacy law, is what I was told. So Washington has been working on it for a long time. States have sort of stepped up. California passed its Comprehensive Privacy Act in 2018, and we've seen a lot of states follow suit individually since then. So it is mostly a conversation that's happening at the state level. Certainly the federal government has a role to play in it. And it would be great to see strong federal law on privacy, but it hasn't happened yet.
I find this interesting, just talking about the new department that's been created, headed by Elon Musk, the Department of Government Efficiency, because I would have to think that on federal devices, if you're doing something personal or not spending all your time on federal work, it seems like something DOGE would be very interested in. So maybe, I don't know if that federal policy will go faster or slower because of everything we're hearing about federal jobs right now. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, that's a really good question. You know, I admit I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know 100% sort of what the rules are governing devices, but I do think, you know, there have been already renewed discussions in Congress about, you know, sort of taking another swing at a consumer privacy bill. Certainly, there are a lot of questions about how some of the actions that are being taken right now intersect with current privacy law. But I don't have a crystal ball. I wish I had an accurate crystal ball and I could tell you what was going to happen.
I spend a lot of time on the show asking people to predict the future, so that's okay. But I want to thank you for your time today. That's Haley Sokoyama, an Associate Director of Legislative Activism with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF for short, a digital rights group. Haley, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up, we're going to talk about Apple's newest phone. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. Apple is releasing a new phone aimed at those on a lower budget that breaks from their traditional release schedule. The iPhone 16e will cost about $200 less than the next cheapest current iPhone, and but that could be at the expense of losing a few features. Joining us now is Russell Holliday, Managing Editor of Commerce at CNET. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So what is different about the iPhone 16e from the other iPhone 16s?
Yeah, so it's missing a couple of things, as you pointed out. In order to, save some of that cost, Apple removed a couple of pieces of hardware that you may be familiar with if you own an iPhone that has been released in the last two generations. The first being that magnetic attachment in the back that allows you to do the charging wirelessly, or connect to a magnetic car dock. This is something that Apple has had on all of their phones for the last couple of years, and it will not be a part of the iPhone 16e. It's also only got a single camera in the back to take, kind of standard photos. So if you were to open an iPhone that was made in the last couple of years, as usually even the kind of the baseline model has two cameras, so you have an ultra wide camera to be able to take, panoramas and things like that. That camera is now gone, and it's also going to be just slightly lighter, and miss that notch in the front where, Apple has included some animations and things like that. So that like weird pill-shaped black spot that you would see in the last couple of generations of iPhones is not going to be a part of this. They're going to go back to a previous design.
So why are they offering this is kind of out of their schedule. They've been doing just like one phone a year, right? So why offer a 16E?
Apple is very well aware and has been aware for a couple of years now that there's a consistent need for kind of a budget phone that reaches, one allows them to operate with prepaid carriers, so that they're selling kind of less expensive phones because those are the phones that tend to sell for, some of those carriers. So companies like Mint Mobile would be able to carry this phone at a discounted rate and be able to offer that. Apple also has been working really hard for the last 5 years now to kind of free itself from its reliance on the company Qualcomm. Qualcomm makes all of the cellular radios inside of every phone that is made in the US, and allows you to connect to Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile, and all those and enjoy, kind of the 5G speeds. Apple had made it really clear a couple of years back that they wanted to make their own version of that mobile radio so that they were no longer dependent on a third party for, for manufacturing. And this is the first phone that will have that. Apple is calling it the C1 modem. And this is a modem that is entirely designed by Apple. It will function, it is supposed to function exactly the same as Qualcomm's modem, but we'll be testing that in the next couple of weeks to make sure that that actually holds up. And that's, the big, kind of push here is Apple signaling that this is something you could expect to see in future generations of phones. So in a weird way, folks who pick this phone up for the next couple of months will more or less be beta testing this for Apple.
Oh, yeah. That made me a little nervous to think about Apple taking something that's been used for years that makes the phone work and doing that on their own. So do you expect some bugs in the 16E?
I don't know about bugs, but there are always, anytime there's a new radio that gets included in a phone, one of the first questions that comes to my mind is power. How much energy it consumes in order to do the things that it says that it's going to do. And historically, modems that are not made by Qualcomm have tend to be a little more energy, kind of consistent. They pull a little more power in order to do very much the same thing. And Apple seems to have addressed this in a little way by making sure that this phone has a slightly larger battery in it than the iPhone 16, which it made space for by removing some of that additional hardware. It is entirely likely that this cellular radio will work just fine, but it'll end up drawing a little more power, which will mean that the next generation of iPhones may need to have some of those larger batteries as well.
Now, the article I read from CNET about this iPhone 16e had a lot of speculation about the iPhone 17, if that's what they call it. Is that something that we really just know nothing about what is going to come out in its next scheduled release?
That's exactly right. Apple's usually pretty tight-lipped about when it's going to release phones. This is something that we would likely not see until the fall, in line with their pretty usual release schedule, sometime early September. There would be an announcement for it, and then a couple of weeks later, the phone would be available for purchase. But there's a lot of stuff that Apple is working really hard to test over the next couple of months, not just this new cellular radio, but also the effects of its Apple Intelligence campaign that it has been slowly adding to phones, and the effects that that's going to have on things like battery life and how people are actually using their phones. And so a lot of that information, Apple's going to have to move very quickly to make any changes that they can make, because the life cycle of creating a phone is not measured in weeks or months, but years. And so any changes that would be made to the iPhone 17 would really have to start being made very, very quickly in order for it to be reflected in the next phone launch in the end of September.
Is the 16E out right now or not quite yet?
The 16E is going to go on sale on Friday, and it'll be available for pickup in stores the week after.
Okay, so and I didn't write down the amount. It's $200 less. So what is that, $600?
Yeah, so it's $599 for kind of the base version. The standard model iPhone 16 is $799. And again, this phone seems to do just about everything that the iPhone 16 can currently do from a software perspective, but it's missing a couple of those hardware features in order to help save some of that money. And it's a little too early to tell what this new radio is going to be capable of compared to what Qualcomm's radio in the existing iPhone 16 is going to do. It could end up being way better. We won't know until we've had time to test it.
It's interesting, just perspective. I can imagine talking to my grandma 10 or 20 years ago and being like, the cheap phone is $5.99. What she would say to that.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and we're also we kind of live in a society that is post, paying those monthly subscriptions for phones in a lot of cases. So it really is, and it ends up being in a lot of cases that you're paying for that phone outright.
Yeah. Or your carrier is constantly bugging you and saying, "We'll give it to you for free. We'll give it to you for free." And you're just like, "Nothing is free. I don't understand what you're trying to do to me."
That's right.
And do you recommend, just from your experience at CNET, do people get new phones every year, or do you, if you're an iPhone person, do they tend to keep them? I mean, I keep mine for several years.
It very much depends on the person. There is a small set of people that upgrade every year just because they're very excited by the latest and greatest and kind of the shiniest thing that they can get their hands on. That is by far a minority. The average iPhone user upgrades every 3 years, according to current global statistics. And a lot of that is either dependent on the update cycle that is afforded to them by their carrier, where there is some sort of kind of discount that is afforded to them every couple of years. But yeah, in most cases, it's once every 3 years.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides, and we're talking with Russell Hawley, Managing Editor of Commerce at CNET. And the company Humane, which created wearable AI pins, was acquired by AP, and support for these pins will end this week. The AI pins were used for a wide range of applications, and they'll be shutting down soon with minimal fanfare. Now, Russell, I'm going to be honest, 100% honest. I had to look up what an AI pin was. It was, am I out of touch, or did these things just not take off?
So this is something that was announced not at this past CES, but at the one before, where it was on display for a couple of folks to go and check out. It was just a small square, not terribly wider than your two thumbs side by side, that you could wear magnetically attached to a shirt. And it made a ton of promises that it was going to use AI in order to do things like image recognition, where you could say, hey, take a picture of this and tell me what it is. And it would just do so audibly. With you, it had the ability to project certain images on a wall in front of you so that you could, kind of see the information that it was doing. And it offered, it made a ton of promises about being able to do search and save information, for personal experiences and things like that. It was supposed to be this physical companion that was kind of with you wherever you went, and kind of supported whatever your day-to-day activities were using AI. In our tests shortly after its announcement, we found that it really struggled to do any of those things without doing things like overheating or getting the information incorrect. Like it was a very pretty piece of technology that just did not live up to the promises that were made by the company. That company has tried over the last 9 months to kind of right the ship and adjust things via software and make some small improvements where it could, but it just wasn't able to recover from that initial disappointment for a lot of folks. It's kind of hard when you promise the communicator from Star Trek and that's not what you end up delivering in a lot of cases. So, they sold the entire company was acquired by Hewlett Packard. So HP now owns the tech behind Humane, and what HP decided was that they were not interested in the hardware part because it just wasn't living up to expectations. So they're shutting that down completely. If you own one of the Humane AI pins, it's actually going to stop functioning entirely on February 28th.
Wow. Why did AP want to buy it? When I think AP, I just think printers. So are they going to make a Star Trek printer?
Yeah, so a lot of it is the underlying artificial intelligence. This is every company is trying to make some kind of stride when it comes to AI right now, be it for good or not. And the overall goal there was for this company to take some of that underlying technology and be able to apply it to other things, within, you know, their scope of products. So this might be something that we only ever see again reflected in enterprise products, because that's where HP ends up making a lot of their tech. But it's not something we'll see anytime soon, I don't think.
Okay. I don't know if you would know how many people actually own these AI pins. Like, how are there hundreds out there, thousands that just stop working, or not that many?
Yeah, so there are definitely they had announced shortly after it had gone live that they had sold more than 10,000 of them. So there are some out there in the world, and most of them are here in the US. I have personally only seen two of them in the wild, you know, people that I didn't know who actually owned them and were wearing them. But in neither situation were they particularly happy with their purchase. They were just wearing it because they had spent an enormous amount of money on this thing that they were trying to get some use out of. It's, you know, the big thing, if you did make this purchase and you are interested in recovering any of the information that you had stored on that pin, you have until the 28th to do so.
I can imagine you running up to someone in the wild and being like, you actually bought one of those. And they're like, I know.
I generally try not to be that insulting. But yeah, you know, I'm curious to see what their thoughts are. And I'm not overly surprised when the response is disappointment.
Yeah. Well, our final topic for today is, not an odd one for the tech segment, but it's about coffee pots. Coffee brewing experts are working to raise awareness of some common brewing mistakes that people often make at home. A number of potential missteps ranging from cleaning your pot with the wrong materials to buying bad beans. So what did you learn about cleaning coffee pots from this article in CNET?
I find one of the more fascinating things about when it comes to kitchen tech in general is that as a 39-year-old man, I do very little correct according to the internet. And this coffee pot one was a really great reminder as someone who has only ever done things like wash the coffee maker, the coffee pot, you know, as soon as it's empty, and done things like that. Apparently, you're not supposed to. There several, you know, coffee experts from across the world were interviewed about, you know, kind of bad habits that that a lot of different folks who make coffee at home get into. And the one that was at the top was that washing your coffee pot every single time you use it runs the risk of actually leaving detergent film on the inside of the coffee pot, which will ruin the coffee that you're making.
Yeah. So, I mean, the article said basically just if you want to clean it, run hot water through it.
That's right. Yeah. Soap tends to, because glass is at least semi-porous, you know, the detergent, even if you have thoroughly rinsed it out, there's no guarantee that you have completely eliminated that. When you put hot coffee in, the hot liquid causes those pores to expand slightly, which can release the detergent that is stored inside of them.
This seems like a tough assignment for your writer at CNET. Go drink coffee and learn what will make it taste better.
We all make sacrifices in different ways, you know, in order to make sure that we're providing things. The other one that I thought was really interesting from a technical perspective is whether you're, you know, using a coffee pot or a Keurig machine or a pour over system, that if you are trying to, you know, kind of mix and match things until you get kind of the perfect combination of ingredients, to make sure that you're adjusting multiple things at a time. So if you're deciding that you need to make sure that you have the temperature of the water correct, or how much cream you're adding, or, you know, whether you're, you know, kind of grinding or, you know, kind of using pour over techniques, to when you're making those changes, that you'll learn more by making multiple changes at the same time, which is counterintuitive to how I would do things. And, you know, whereas I'm usually like, you know, document, you know, individual changes that I make, I am also rarely on the hunt for a perfect cup of coffee. So what do I know?
I'm on the hunt for coffee with caffeine. That's what I'm on the hunt for.
That's exactly right. Right. As long as the thing that happens after the cup is empty happens, then you're happy.
Yes, I'm in, up here for the result. I mean, the taste is okay. The piece also mentioned not using tap water, which I immediately was like, okay, I do everything wrong.
Right. Yeah. I do enjoy the internet regularly telling me that I do things wrong in the kitchen. It seems to happen a lot these days.
Okay. Well, Russell, I want to thank you so much for your time. This has been Tech Tuesday, and that was Managing Editor of Commerce for CNET, Russell Hawley. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
And are you going to go get a cup of coffee now in your not clean coffee pot?
I am having a cup of coffee right now.
All right. Thank you for joining us. And again, that was Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET, Russell Hawley. And this has been Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jarovich on 89.7 NPR News.